This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this weekend, the Music for a Great Space concert series presents Simpatico Percussion Quintet. If you're thinking loud snare drums, bass drums, and maybe a cymbal crash or two, think again. Sure, when it comes to putting out volume, the ensemble can take it to 11, but the musicians that make up Simpatico can also play as soft as a whisper and every dynamic gradient in between. And they do so on dozens and dozens of different percussion instruments, many of which come from the far corners of the world. Simpatico's Christopher Norton spoke with me recently about the ensemble's diverse and eclectic repertoire. In terms of putting together your programs, I'm wondering if there are any criterion for the ensemble in putting together the program itself and selecting the music. What are you hoping to get?
Well, the selection of the repertoire is to absolutely be appealing and accessible to all audiences. And we like diversity. We think audiences like diversity. And so in our program, with the instruments that we have, they're all sorts of sounds, but style-wise, we're playing ragtime. We're doing some all-out drumming. We mix together metals and woods and marimbas and harmony and melody and exciting rhythms. So there's something for everyone there. And then it's not just all loud and in your face, but there's also poignancy and expression and reflection. And when people wonder, what would it be to have five percussionists together? Is that just all drumming? It's just everything you can imagine. Even the piece that opens the program with the five of us, I think we probably play 20 different instruments, from pitched instruments like the glockenspiel and the crotales and the marimba, to drums and to pieces of metal and resonant cowbells. So there's something on our program for everyone.
You also perform symphonically with an orchestra or have for years. What's the best part of orchestral percussion playing?
Well, in playing, whether it's with an orchestra or in any chamber setting, it's what you bring into that setting as a collaborative artist. And with percussion, a lot of times that can be pretty dramatic, whether it's at the high point of the music and you get to play that cymbal crash, whether it's the timpani roll that leads into the high point, or maybe it's a color in Ravel and there's just some sort of specialized sound that creates something otherworldly. We get to do those things in the percussion section and be a contributing voice in that way, and in some ways an individualistic voice, because we're the only one on our particular percussion instrument, and so we enjoy doing that.
Do you know John Beck?
I sure do.
Yeah, John's right here on campus, and I've spoken with him several times about this at length of my appreciation for those percussionists who just got into hitting the center or just off-center part of a cymbal or the triangle, holding it just a certain way to get the ultimate sound that they're after. But that takes a certain type of personality to gravitate toward that aspect versus, say, being a flutist or what have you. When were you first drawn to those aspects of music making, and what really grabbed your imagination?
Well, I think part of what you're describing is that as musicians, hopefully, we're all consumed with sound, whether that is the sound on the clarinet or the sound on the suspended cymbal. It's just that we have to ponder that sound on 80 different instruments. So where am I going to strike the marimba bar and either heighten the high partials or the fundamental, and with what kind of mallet? Well, that's one marimba bar, and, you know, what about the cymbal or the triangle or the tambourine or the doombek or the djembe or the timpani? So we have to be consumed not only with the sound across all of those instruments, but also how we play them and our whole background for that.
The variety of approaches, limitless, really. Are you still, Chris, picking up a new world instrument, say, and learning new techniques as you go along?
Well, it is interesting that when you've been at it a while, you're learning most of the percussion instruments, and yet I am surprised that each year I'll encounter a piece either with an instrument that I have not played before, or it hasn't been used in that particular fashion. This is a little peculiar example, but on one of the pieces on the program we're going to play, we were looking for just the right voice in this one stretch of a piece, and someone had this idea of a melodica, which is a mouth organ. And so we asked one of our players, Scott Herring, we said, you know, let's give that a try right here. And it turned out to be just the right instrument. I can't say that Scott's ever played that instrument before.
I was going to ask you, I mean, if you are there, and I mean, half the fun of the performance for many listeners is going to be just seeing you all perform. It's such a oftentimes physical endeavor. How would you learn to play, say, for example, a Brazilian cuíca, if you don't have a Brazilian percussionist here to show you? How does a percussionist go about it?
Nowadays, of course, we do have the advantage of the internet, so there can be some self-instruction that way. But I think, you know, all the members of Simpatico, we attended concerts, we went to conservatories and school and got training across the instruments, and the schools themselves were bringing in various groups. So we've learned that way, and there are enough instructors around of these instruments. If we don't know how to play it, we know who to call.
The Charleston Capers, you know, the lighthearted piece on the program early on from 1930, the perfect music for percussion ensembles. I mean, you really make it sound like lots of fun, but there's some pretty serious stick work going on there, pretty virtuosic stuff.
What we try to do in the program is not only have variety, but have one piece for each player of the ensemble to be really featured in maybe one of their favorite zones. And so Susan Powell is just a phenomenal, world-class xylophone ragtime player. And so she just, the way she plays capers, it's part of the fun about being in Simpatico. When I see each person featured, my jaw is still hitting the ground. I'm smiling every time she plays capers and being amazed. You know, she's really studied the style when that came about. So, you know, George Hamilton Green, Joe Green being the masters at the early part of the 20th century, xylophone being great because it projected well on early radio. It recorded well on those wax cylinders. But there was a style of playing it that she has studied and not only emulated, but gone beyond.
It's a great carousel-like sound, the whole choir playing together like that. How many instruments are performing?
The standard setup is you have your soloist out front, Susan, on the xylophone, playing with slightly harder mallets and the xylophone being a little more brilliant. And then there are two marimbas with two players on each marimba.
Spider Dreams. You had me, this is from 1992, you had me hearkening back to the Return to Forever days early on, the No Mystery with Chick Corea. And remember that? I think Lenny White was playing that.
He sure was, and I saw that group, Return to Forever, and with Lenny White on drums, and of course that was before video cameras, so Lenny White would have a panel of mirrors above him so you could see the top of the heads, the drum heads from the mirrors. It was just so cool. But you're right, it is that kind of style. Spider Dreams was written for the Turtle Island String Quartet, and a student of mine years ago heard the recording, liked that piece, transcribed every part by ear, and said, hey, look at what I did. We played it, so then I borrowed it for the Simpatico group, and we've had a good time with it. Not only playing the string quartet part and adapting it to our three marimbas and vibraphone, But we've added Joe Krieger in the mix for the coolness factor, and he plays on different hand drums and maybe a cajon and some shakers that really spice it up a good bit.
Love the variety too, because you get these funky little jazz breaks, and then we're off to the islands, and boy, just there's a whole journey there.
Well, and the ending section almost sounds to me a little like Nashville bluegrass, doesn't it?
I was treated to an epic piece in the program, Slow Swirl at the Edge of the Sea from 1990. It's a real 10-minute journey.
Mark Duggan, Canadian composer, a very wonderful, different voice. The collection of those instruments, the extended harmonies that he uses. And really, I think each section of that piece having a very distinct, reflective character. The title was inspired by a Mark Rothke painting, so I can see some of that inspiration in there.
The colors are jumping off of the sonic colors, I should say, jumping up at you. What are we hearing instrumentally speaking?
I think a lot of what you're hearing are crotales, glockenspiel, some triangles, some smaller cymbals, and even some high-pitched gongs. And there may even be another metal voice in there of, if you could imagine, a very resonant cowbell played with a softer mallet.
In addition to the performance coming up for Music for a Great Space, you're going to be doing some teaching while you're here in the Triad. What's that educational outreach going to look like?
A lot of times we do like to talk about working in a smaller chamber ensemble, not just because that's us, but also because that's a component of what they do in percussion ensembles at the university. Then we'll be out in the elementary schools, and then there'll be some elementary schools coming to the actual performance venue. And that's great fun for us, opening young eyes to the world of percussion, hearing their questions, which are just so creative, and hopefully interesting them in music for the future.
Chris, why is it important? Why do we need to introduce these young people to, in this case, percussion?
Part of the heady way I like to explain this is, of all the subjects they'll do, this subject of music, and particularly percussion, crosses the three learning domains. The psychomotor domain, right? When you're moving around and using your mind, the cognitive domain and the affective domain, the emotions, it's all there. And we can't say that for every subject. And that's why I don't think it should be extracurricular if we're trying to, particularly K through 12, teach people how to think and how to learn. Let's use all those learning domains that are so important. Whether they themselves are going to go on and be musicians or they're going to be consumers of music, but just the value of art and its impact on our life and on society around the world, so crucial. And this is one opportunity we have to connect and influence them.
Percussionist, composer, and educator Christopher Norton. Simpatico Percussion Quintet comes to the Triad this Friday night, January 16th at 7:30 in Christ United Methodist Church in Greensboro. The performance is compliments of Music for a Great Space concert series. We've been sampling from some of the pieces on the program. There'll be several others, and while they're still in town, SBQ will be offering percussion clinics at UNCG, UNCSA, and some local elementary schools as well. You'll find more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Thanks for joining me today on Triad Arts Weekend. Now, has the specter of stuffy tuxedos, opera glasses, and throat lozenges kept you away from classical music concert halls all these years? Well, fear not, because, well, first of all, you're not alone, and second, Classical Revolution Greensboro is here to help. Cellist Brian Carter shares the method behind his chamber music madness just about 10 minutes from now. Spoiler alert, it's free, and it involves barley. But before we go there, put your beer mug down, grab yourself a cup of herbal tea, breathe deeply, relax, and get set for a very different sort of musical experience. Pianist-composer Nathan Spear draws his inspiration from a wide variety of sources, including late and modern classical and jazz composers, New Age artists, minimalist composers like Steve Reich and Arvo Pärt, and sacred Byzantine music. His new album, which was just released last week, captures the essence of his journey through life and lessons he's learned along the way. It's titled The Emotive Leaf, and we're sampling from it right now. Why do you write music? Why do you do this? It's not easy.
No, it's not. But when I started writing music, it was experimenting on actually like an instrument. It was at my cousin's house, a keyboard. I ended up inheriting a piano. It was kind of like a process of self-discovery along with experimenting. So it's just been like a more of an adventure or exploration for me. I don't even know what's going to come out sometimes until I start writing. And when I write and I realize what's happened at the end, it's just sometimes like something that puts me back. It takes me back.
And that started when you were preteen, right?
Yeah, I was writing. I actually wrote down or notated after having some formal music lessons my first song when I was 12 or 13. And I was playing around with my own compositions before then, just noodling on the piano and saying, hey, look what I wrote, and I try to remember what I had put together. And that was my idea of a formal song at that point.
It's hard to describe for people who don't write. Could you give a listener like a sense of the joy of that experimentation, that sense of discovery?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I'm putting together something and I add some intention to it, because that's part of what composition involves in the end, it's besides just a moment that you photographed, musically or in a recording, you intentionally organize, put things together a certain way with your rhythm and your space, and that becomes something. And so music, with its movement and the reiterations of all the rhythms and the silence between, becomes an ongoing experience. So that has a whole other dynamic from visual art.
I mean, you've been obviously doing, in addition to a lot of composing, a lot of listening, and just looking through some of your influences, I was struck by the number of artists, and specifically like Steve Reich and Arvo Pärt, the minimalist guys. I guess you could throw Philip Glass into that group. And what is it about that approach to writing that grabs you?
Those composers, for me, have always grabbed me because of the experience and their minimalism, the way that they have orchestrated silence around all their sound has a moving effect on the consciousness. And that experience just enhances everything I've experienced around me, naturalistically, really holistically.
You said something in there that I thought was interesting. I've never heard it expressed that way, which is orchestrating silence.
Oh, yeah. Use of silence in music, to me, is a big thing. I didn't always think of it that way till maybe I started checking out some really avant-garde stuff and college, you know, like John Cage, or maybe like a composition, you know, 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. There's a kind of a revelation comes on about everything that's included between the movement around you. Life itself is full of so much movement. There's space in between. We just don't always realize it. Orchestrating silence is a way of not only just enhancing what you do here, but by the spaces in between that you don't, there is a pulse that's created around a whole piece. And that affects the experience of what is played or what is not played.
The Emotive Leaf. Tell me about the title of the album. How did that come to you?
When I arrived at that title, I had in mind this image of like a diary. I had an image of a something that kind of had grown to fruit and was almost sweet enough to make you cry, that was really about to go. You have your chance to take a bite, but it was going to be for a limited amount of time. It was a sweet, bittersweet experience that was just about to fall away and leave an impression on you. So the combination of a leaflet you would write on for a diary and a colorful, fully colored leaf from the fall from a deciduous tree that just impresses you for a moment before it's about to dissipate into a silent winter is how I arrived at that title, The Emotive Leaf. That's when I said, that's it.
Dark beginning on The Emotive Leaf, but a sudden little harmonic shift early on gives me a sense of that kind of light versus dark struggle. Tell me about this piece.
Yeah, there's a ongoing struggle in there. That's the emotive experience that is the quintessence of that territory I kept tapping into over the year I was recording the album. Then I wasn't even sure that I had a title track until I fully orchestrated it with the strings. And once I had reached that, I said, this is the type of piece that has that tension and beautiful movement that is hitting a spot without making me commit to a certain place, but it's tugging away like a candle warming up some wax. It's supposed to just kind of help warm my heart, and that was the heart of the album. So when I finished orchestrating that piece with the strings, I said, this is the title track. This is The Emotive Leaf.
Mindfulness of Your Pain is the next track, and beautiful meditative opening here.
What Mindfulness of Your Pain was about was when you start to just harness the awareness of somebody suffering, even in a small way, it's moving. It has a calming effect sometimes because it's helpful for yourself, and it can also offer, you know, help to others around you when you acquire that right kind of awareness.
Nothing taps into that sort of awareness, I think, better than the sounds accompanying the piano of wooden flute in a minor key.
Yeah, I got that flute from a craft show in New Hampshire years ago. It was the first Native American flute I ever purchased, and I was in love with it from the first time I picked that one up.
telescopic. I got the sense right off of looking out at the night sky and some film score-ish like sounds as well. Very cinematic.
Yeah, cinematic I think is a good word for that. And this is a stargazing piece. It's not the kind of stargazing piece that puts you in slow motion. It's kind of a childlike contemplative piece when you're having that moment and just venturing out. When thoughts unfold into better thoughts and newer thoughts, it's moment after moment of discovery. Telescopic is what it's about. I had a huge inspiration from the space industry. Grew up a lot of my life on the Space Center in Florida. And a grandfather of mine lives out in Tucson, Arizona, also is into astronomy. The two together have always fascinated me.
Pianist composer Nathan Speer. We've been sampling from his newly released CD, The Emotive Leaf. It's available on CD Baby, iTunes, and Amazon, and you'll find links at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. For decades, the three big B's were Bach, Beethoven, and Berlioz. Then a guy named von Bülow gave Berlioz the hook in favor of Johannes Brahms. But now, Classical Revolution Greensboro is rewriting the Big B's book by adding Brewpub. So how about a little Mozart with your Mackeson Stout? Something hoppy might pair nicely with Haydn, or perhaps, for the hardcore beer drinkers among you, spice up your Schlitz with Shostakovich. Cellist Brian Carter and his chamber music colleagues in Classical Revolution are taking the music straight to the people, wherever they are. And this season, that'll be at Gibbs 100 Brewery in downtown Greensboro. Performances are free, with donations gladly accepted. Hey, a musician's got to eat too. And the musical atmosphere at their performances turns that stuffy concert hall scenario on its ear. I want to get right into this whole notion of Classical Revolution.
And
tell us about it.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, you mentioned Matt Heimovitz before we started recording, and I think when I was an undergraduate student, he was when he started playing the Bach solo suites in bars and other modern music. That was the first time I ever thought about, well, oh, look at that. You can take your cello into a bar in jeans and play this music, and people will pay attention.
And we should point out for listeners, the Bach cello suites unaccompanied some of the most difficult, most challenging music for cello in the repertoire, and,
right.
and the idea of just walking in and playing in a bar.
Yeah, for sure. And that prompted me at that point in my life to, you know, I definitely visited some open mics at coffee houses in Buffalo where I grew up. And, you know, definitely I played a few movements of Bach here and there, to not the same kind of success for sure. But, you know, so I definitely dabbled with it when I was coming up, and then I forgot about it, you know, as all ideas do. And the next thing that kind of got me thinking about getting this art form out of its traditional home in Boston, this Group Muse program has started up, which is... It's sort of like Craigslist, I guess, for chamber music, in that he set up a website and people volunteer to host a concert in their home or their apartment. And the basic idea is that the residents, they set the capacity. They say, you know, you can have 20 people come to this. And then it's pretty much first come, first serve. And so they're basically inviting strangers into their home. Also very informal. You know, if you look at the pictures, everyone's in jeans and, you know, T-shirts and whatever. And it's BYOB. And I guess the hosts can have food or not, and they can mingle or not. You know, and the basic idea is that you present about an hour's worth of music, you have an intermission, the musicians hang out, they talk to everybody, and then they pass a hat at the end, and so the musicians theoretically can earn some money on it. And the amazing thing about it was that the guy that set it up, I don't think he knew what kind of audience he was going to be getting, and next thing he knew, everybody showing up was in their 30s, and it was this whole younger audience set. Talk to any marketing person with any orchestra in the world. That's the audience set that they're trying to grab. And I think, for the most part, not doing a very good job at that.
So why do you think it's a good fit, this sort of, I mean, classical revolution for right. the Greensboro area?
Well, I think the city's ready for another chamber music series, for one. And for two, you know, as I look around, I kind of think of my generation as like this craft beer generation, right? I love brewing beer at home. I like drinking beer. And, you know, all these new breweries are popping up in Greensboro. Gibbs 100, who's our host for this one, you know, being primary amongst that. And I brought my kids there one Sunday as a haircut reward because they have board games instead of TVs.
You got them a beer? What?
Well, no, I drank the beer, but they also, they have some local snacks. So the kids got to eat some chocolate popcorn and we played chutes and ladders, you know. But I was looking around thinking, hey, there's no TVs here. How cool is this? And there were other, you know, other parents with small kids there, like mine, where you can bring dogs there, you can bring your own food. And it was just this really comfy, kind of homey environment. And so just on a lark, I emailed them and said, hey, what do you think about having concerts here? And they were so supportive. And we had a meeting and boom, there it was. And, you know, the way I was looking at it, I really wanted to use Sunday nights as our performance time. Both because, you know, we usually don't have concerts Sunday nights for our orchestras, so players would be available. But I was worried, you know, most bars do have TVs where people are going to show up on a Sunday night expecting to watch a football game. you know, if you walked into your neighborhood bar expecting the Panthers and you got a string quartet, you might be a little upset. So Gibbs 100 really just seemed like the perfect place. You know, so much of the mantra of classical revolution is, you know, doing things new and doing things different. But I almost don't view it that way because this music was all written, you know, for small rooms to be, you know, intimately performed. And so I think in some ways, moving it out of big concert halls back into these small community spaces is almost getting the string quartet and other genres back to its roots, you know, where people can be right up close to the performers and we're not going to be dressed up, and, you know, and we're not going to use programs. We're going to talk to the audience, heaven forbid, you know. And so it's just this idea to really connect with the audience in a way that I don't think happens, you know, at your traditional concert setting.
I enjoy that very much as an audience member, just mm-hmm. having that sort of, yeah, just an intimate setting and feeling like you can really hear the vibrations of the strings, right. et cetera. But from the performer's perspective, what's it like? What does it give you, that access, that sort of being surrounded feel by the audience? Is it a positive?
It is a positive because I think, you know, for instance, the joke quartet, right? It has all these funny moments. And so if we do something and we succeed and it's funny, if people are close, you can see them smile. You can see them react to whatever it is you're playing. And you get sort of that instant feedback of, are we actually communicating here what we're meaning to communicate? Whereas if you're on stage with bright lights, it's actually very hard to see the audience, you know? And so there's that disconnect, too, that I think gets broken down a little bit if everyone's just, you know, close up and there's not concert lighting.
Yeah. Haydn was quite the prankster. He's one of the few composers out there whose jokes, for me, really do it. I mean, every time they get to giggle. From the string quartet's perspective in playing this music, is it all right there? Just like the actor says, you just read the part and it's there. Is there anything you need to do performance-wise to enhance the jokes?
Right. Well, at the risk of completely giving away what the joke is, I'll say it's at the end and it deals with silence. Because of the limitations of notation, Haydn had to write specific amounts of time that this silence occurs that contributes to the joke. And you know, you can either adhere strictly to that and count through the silence, or you can just wait. And I think it's more fun if you just wait, and you wait till it gets maybe slightly uncomfortable, or if someone, you know, giggles or claps. I mean, I remember the first time I played it, we actually goaded the audience into clapping before it was over. We thought that was really successful. So I think there's elements of both. I mean, you can just, you know, as you say, just do what's there, and I think it's funny. But if you milk it up a little bit, I think it's funnier.
I guess I'm coming to Haydn later in life. I'd see Haydn on a program and go, oh no, Haydn. But then some Simon Rattle recordings came along of some of his later symphonies, and then Emerson String Quartet came out with a complete set,
right,
and hit it out of the park. And then I get it. But it has to be done so well.
It does. And I think the challenge with all of that classical era music is that it's, if you don't come at it with this sense of style and like almost like classiness, right? It's got to be fun, but it's got to be really refined. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And I think that's really where the challenge lies. The notes aren't that hard. Right, but it's getting everybody on the same page with getting that everyone that same sense of style and that sense of poise that makes it come alive.
And you get that same level of transparency with Mozart to begin the program and the Adagio and Fugue. Tell us about this piece.
Well, this one, it's a little less lighthearted than the joke. It's in C minor. Mozart took his keys very seriously in terms of what he was trying to express. And so it's got, this very strong sort of dotted rhythms as the Adagio for the introduction and just a very angular fugue. And I think he wrote it, he was exploring a lot of Bach's music and he arranged a lot of Bach preludes and fugues for string trio and for string quartet. I have my timing right. I think he wrote his after doing all those arrangements. So I think it was at a time where he was really studying Bach's use of counterpoint, because really he's the grand master as far as that goes. And I think, he just put his own sort of personal twist on that style of writing.
Yeah. Amazing how influential Bach was, and yet in his own lifetime, more known as an organist, as a keyboardist, than
exactly,
as a composer.
Right.
Pick a moment in either the Adagio or the Fugue. Tell me about a spot that you gravitate toward and you're hoping to really, lay your stamp on coming up.
Sure. Well, I guess it's a little selfish, being the cellist in the quartet. There's two things, actually. The very first note of the piece is just this growling low C string before any of the rhythms start, and I get to do that. And I sort of enjoy that sort of call to attention that I get to do. And also, unlike so many pieces where the cellist is always the last one to play the tune, the cello actually introduces the fugue subject first, all by myself. And also, it's very low register, so I get to kind of, I'm the only one that gets to play down there, as far as, the quartet instruments go. So I think those two moments I really enjoy.
Well, that drama bodes well for the second half of the program. And, Shostakovich 8, always challenging. And how many did he write? Did he write 12 more, 15?
15, I believe.
15 quartets.
Yeah.
Where does this one fit in your mind in terms of the output?
I mean, it's certainly the most popular. It's the one that the most people have played, I think. The Kronos Quartet recorded it early on. And, it's one of the pieces where I will likely never forget the first time I heard it. It's the longest piece on the program. It's in five movements, and there's no break between the movements. And I think that in of itself sort of lends itself to, it has this arc where you don't really get a chance to breathe in this piece, from a listening standpoint. And I remember the first time I heard it, it's a piece that both starts and ends quietly, as a lot of Shostakovich pieces do. And it was done. I almost felt like I couldn't speak for a little while after I heard it, because it's this really intense emotional journey through both sort of quietude places and very intense, raucous places. After the fact, so many people try to attribute, what they think Shostakovich was trying to do with all these things. I won't bother with that. But it does have some of his typical stamps. You've got the DFCH little motive at the very beginning of the quartet, which is his initials, of course, and a motive he used in the first cello concerto and in the, the second piano trio. It comes up a lot.
Could you break that down for listeners? Because each letter represented by a note.
Right. So D is obviously the pitch D, C is C, and H is B natural. And it's just this little stamp. And he uses those intervals. It's not always those specific pitches. He uses those intervals as just his own little way to say, like, here's my name. And Bach did this too. You know, and there are moments in it, I think it's the fourth movement, there's this rhythm, this knocking, this, you know, which is, the story is that that's the KGB knocking on the door to come get Shostakovich, who always had a suitcase packed, I guess. And that's into some of his letters, I believe. You know, because at that time, you know, in Stalinist Russia, there was a lot of composers were disappearing. Prokofiev was in Siberia for a while and came back. And so Shostakovich definitely lived with that. And I think that that air is sort of cast over a lot of his music, and this one's not immune to it. Most people, whether they're familiar with this kind of music or not, it elicits an emotional response, whether it's the noisy parts, whether it's the dissonant parts, or the beautiful parts that are surrounded by some dissonance and noise, you know. I think there's something in Shostakovich that every human can sort of latch onto. And that's one of the reasons I really wanted to play this piece on this kind of program, is our hope is that everyone that shows up won't have heard a string quartet before. You know, people who might, again, like be turned off by the whole concert hall idea, who could just be wandering by the bar and say, hey, what's going on in here? And walk in and there we are.
Cellist, educator, and Classical Revolution Greensboro organizer Brian Carter. The Revolution is coming to Gibbs 100 Brewery in downtown Greensboro Sunday night, January 18th at 8 o'clock with the Rail Yard String Quartet, violinists Rebecca Willey and Nayara Sanchez, violist Noah Hawk, and cellist, my guest today, Brian Carter. On the musical menu, Mozart, Haydn, and Shostakovich. And on the Barley Pop menu, it's Gibbs's Guilty Party ESB, Cherchez la Femme Milk Stout, and Blind Man's Holiday Greensboro Pale Ale, with more house recipes and seasonals coming soon. The day after Valentine's Day, Classical Revolution presents Love Songs, of course, with some of the Triad's finest singers accompanied by strings. And then on March 22nd, it'll be a shift of gears with the renowned Red Clay Saxophone Quartet taking it into overdrive. All performances are at 8 at Gibbs in Greensboro. You'll find the complete Classical Revolution performance calendar, Facebook page, Twitter feed, and website at our website. That'll be WFDD.org. Just be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and you know, there's always so much going on, artistically speaking, here in the Triad and surrounding areas that, well, quite frankly, we cannot possibly keep up with all the amazing happenings. But by golly, we can sure give it the old college try.
Indeed, we sure can.
All right. Well, by we, of course, I mean Triad Arts Weekend technical producer Eddie Garcia. Hello there, Eddie.
Hello.
And associate producer Bethany Chafin.
Hey, everyone.
Howdy. Well, in this this spirit of inclusion that we're joining forces right now, and we want to provide you, our valued listeners, with as many artistic options as we possibly can cram into one 52-minute program. Good ones, though. And in fact, we've come up with an entirely new TOSS segment that we call...
Well, we debated this, didn't we, guys?
We
had a few options on the table.
What do we got?
I think some of the options, we talked about tuning into the Triad, an arts roundtable. David took a more literal route, maybe with Triad Arts Recommendation Time, TART for short.
I like that.
Everyone had a good association
with TART, like Pop-Tarts.
Exactly. Sprinkles. Know what you're getting.
Yeah.
But I think what we decided to go with is a Triad To-Dos.
I think it's a great idea. And since it was your idea, what do you got? What's cooking?
So this weekend, and actually all through January, you can check out, there's an exhibit at DeLurk Gallery in Winston-Salem. It's called The Little Things. And this was an exhibit that they had an open call for submissions. So instead of sort of curating it in the traditional way, an open call for 2D and 3D pieces of art that could be no bigger than 14 inches. So small art, basically, the little things. And the interesting thing about this exhibit is because you are working with smaller pieces of art, that means more space to exhibit art. So there are a total of 51 artists included in this. And so I think it's an awesome way to see what's going on with a lot of the area artists and what they're thinking. And might be on a small scale, but I think what they're communicating are some big ideas. So go check it out. That would be my recommendation. And I think as far as Eddie, I know Eddie and I have been talking about films in the hallway, I think, since we got back from the holidays. Mm-hmm. So if I had to wager, I would guess that maybe your recommendations and ideas have to do with movies.
Yeah, I got a couple of things about movies on my mind right now. One first thing I want to mention is that opening this week in an Aperture Cinema is a film called Whiplash, which has gotten lots of really great advanced praise. It's a film about jazz drumming, which is been said to demolish the cliches of kind of the musical mentor prodigy genre thing. It's supposed to be more akin to like a psychological battle that's more fit for an arena than the conservatory. It's supposed to be really, really good film. Supporting actor J.K. Simmons, he just won Best Supporting Actor at the Golden Globes a couple of nights ago. And on Thursday morning when they announced the Academy Award nominations, it was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Supporting Actor for J.K. Simmons again. So that's opening at Aperture this weekend. In the realm of the Oscars, I just want to put this out there. The Lego Movie is something we had talked about on Triad Arts weekend before. Isn't that correct?
Was it Dale?
Dale Pollack talked about the Lego Movie and talked about how he enjoyed it, but the thing about branding and whatnot. It's a pretty interesting piece, which you can listen to on our website. Well, the Lego Movie was a critical and commercial darling of 2014 as far as animated features go. It has intergenerational appeal. It wasn't nominated for Best Animated Film. Now, the news just came out on Thursday, and people's minds are kind of blown, and I'm a little confused. So I'm curious if it's a branding thing. Is it because, you know, it's related to a toy? Did maybe the Academy just decide not to look into it any deeper? It seems a little odd.
That seems very odd. So especially when you think of how many movies where they purposely plant, like, a Coke can or something,
yes,
a brand in the movie itself.
Yeah, so Lego Movie, it's definitely worth checking out. Interesting that it wasn't included. But the film Box Trolls was nominated, which was a great stop-motion animated film that kind of flew under the radar, and I would recommend everyone check that out.
Great.
Now, all I can think about now is that song from the Lego Movie. I just thank you for that. It'll be stuck in my head all day.
Everything is awesome. Everything is cool, and it's going my way. Yes, yeah. I have a 10-year-old. But even if I didn't, I thought that was great for kids
great.
And adults. I laughed. I went in there cynically, but I came out of that really laughing.
I did too.
I think we've talked to adults and children about it. Everyone seems to like it.
I love Triad to Do's already because I got to live out a dream of mine. That was a bucket list. Singing, everything is awesome on the radio for all of our listeners. Well, I'm the last left in the room, the last one left standing.
Let's
hear it, dude. So this one is actually, and I'm stretching the rules already because this is actually for next week. But, we were unable to fit in this one. Let me tell you a little bit about Bookmarks. It's a fantastic organization, and they bring award-winning authors in for lectures and signing books and introducing books to kids and authors. It's just an all-around amazing group. And anyhows, they are having their third annual Movable Feast on Sunday, January 25th. They're going to feature 20-plus authors from across the country at this Movable Feast. Each of the authors, 10 authors, comes across the table and they give a little spiel, talk about their book, and maybe answer a few questions. You went to one of these, didn't you?
I did. I went last year and I had a great time. Yeah. I highly recommend it as well. I'm going to piggyback on your recommendation and give it another thumbs up.
All right. Well, all the more the merrier. It just sounds great. And I know Ginger Hendricks runs that organization very well and brings in only the best. And one of the authors, is Corrine McCandless. Her memoir, The Wild Truth, tells this backstory of her brother, Chris. John Krakauer wrote a book about him called Into the Wild, and they made that into a movie. Mm-hmm. Chris is the guy who gave away his savings, hitchhiked to Alaska, and then he walked into the darkness alone, starved to death. His sister, Corrine, has appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show and the CBS Sunday Morning, and I caught her on Morning Joe a few weeks ago talking about it. It sounds fascinating. She'll be stopping by the table to chat, along with 10 other authors. And it sounds like fun. So that's my pick.
Great. I have more things to do than I thought I did.
Isn't that always the case? So much going on in the Triad. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And you'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to all of our guests and events and more on our website, wfdd.org. Just be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend. And as always, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email. That address is triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.